Today's Teisho will be on case 62 in the Book of Serenity. Mihu's Enlightenment or Not. Introduction. Bodhidharma's Highest Truth. Emperor Wu's Confusion. Vimalakirti's Teaching of Non-Duality. Manjushri's Verbal Excess. Is there anyone who has the ability to enter in actively? Case. Mihu had a monk ask Yangshan, "Do people these days need enlightenment or not?" Yangshan said, "It is not that there is no need for enlightenment, but what can be done about falling back into the secondary?" The monk went back and reported this to Mihu. Mihu deeply agreed. Verse. The secondary, distinguishing enlightenment, breaking up delusion. Quickly, you should free your hands and relinquish the net and the trap. Accomplishment, before it's exhausted, becomes an extra thumb. Wisdom can hardly know, like you can't bite your own navel. The full moon's icy disk weeps in the autumn dew. The birds are cold in the jade tree. The dawn breezes chill. Brought forth, great yang distinguishes real and false, completely without flaw. The white jade is esteemed. I want to thank everybody for coming here this morning and practicing the beautiful way of Zen, of Chan. And it's just a beautiful morning. Coming up here, I noticed that all the trees are putting out their leaves. The flowering trees on campus have blossomed. It's chilly, a little chilly, but it's quite beautiful. And it's a wonderful, wonderful time to practice Zen. Of course, there's no time that isn't in mind. Well, if there's no time, it isn't wonderful to practice Zen. But these are like beautiful adornments on the path, right? When it's snowing, it's beautiful. It somehow makes sitting more beautiful. When spring comes, somehow sitting takes on a new depth, new beauty, new freshness. When we see the blossoms on the tree as we come into the Zendo, we somehow feel maybe that we're blossoming ourselves. It enriches us somehow, I think. Anyway, I know that some of you, or I think that some of you, are here for the first time today, and you may not have heard a Teisho before. Some of you have been listening to Teishos here for 10 years. I received a letter the other day from a friend of mine who has been practicing for a long time, an old Dharma friend. And we practiced together for maybe 10 years. And my Dharma friend and I haven't seen each other for quite a long while. But he wrote me a letter. He's not studying with Genki Roshi or Webb. Studying with another teacher out in California. And he wrote me and he said, my teacher is a nice guy, and I have learned a few things from him. But basically, I think I've reached the limit of all I can learn from this teacher. When I sit down and listen to his Teishos, his Dharma talks, I know exactly what he's going to say. He says, I could give the talk myself. That's what he actually wrote. I feel that I could give the talk myself. I know so well what he's going to say. Of course, when I read those words, it was very humbling for me. Because I'm sure many of you are in that position. So if I'm telling a story about what a poor Zen student I was, I can tell you of all the different answers I tried to give to Genki Roshi in Dokusan. And you'll know, okay, he's about to bring in a flower, he's about to bring in a rock, he's about to bring in a sandwich. And when you hear the story again, you know, you could tell it yourself, right? Genki Roshi had quite a few stories like that too. You know, he would tell us about how he had to go to, you know, his first Kensho experience happened in the bathroom. He was a very young monk. He wasn't even 20 years old, and he was already doing sesshin. I think he was around 14 when he was doing sesshin. And he used to say, and you've all heard this story before, you know, as I had heard it many times, he would be sitting in the Zendo and hoping that an earthquake would come so that the Zendo would collapse on his head and just kill him. And he was abjectly unhappy, and then he went into the bathroom. And in a Zen temple, in a Buddhist temple, there's an altar in the bathroom. Because, of course, urinating and defecating are the most sacred acts, right? No question about it. They're deeply sacred acts. And very, very beautiful acts. And so there's an altar next to the hole in the floor, basically. And flowers on the altar. And Genki Roshi was undoing his robes to use the facilities. He looked over at the flowers, and suddenly he felt that he was the flowers, and tears were flowing down his face. So I've told you that story, I think, many times, and Genki had told it to us many times. And every time he would start, he would say, and then I was sitting there hoping an earthquake would come, right? And we'd think, oh, and kill you, yes, you know. And then you went to the bathroom, right? You know. Still a very moving story. But the thing is, I have to tell you the truth. I was shocked by my friend's letter. I was shocked. I mean, it was a little humbling because I realized how often this has been the case, but been the case here, everybody hearing the same old stories from me. But I was shocked by my friend's letter because I thought, this man has practiced all these years, and he still hasn't gotten very far. I was shocked. This, after all these years of Zen, he still thinks this way. Please understand that the deepest part of the Teisho is not the content of what I have to say, right? Or what Genki had to say, or what this very able Zen teacher in California has to say. That's the least valuable part of the Teisho. So when we recite our sutras, some of you may not have recited these sutras before. Our sutras are Japanese phonetic pronunciations of Chinese phonetic pronunciations of Sanskrit, yeah? Which is basically a dead language. Yeah? So in the old days in Catholic churches, people used to recite Latin, which is a dead language. But imagine if they recited French phonetic pronunciations of Latin, and based on, say, you know, Italian pronunciations of Latin, and so on. That's kind of what we do. And years ago, there was a person who sat with us for a while, and then he left. And I ran into him on the street one day, and he said, in a very, I have to say, a very condescending way, he said, "Are you still reciting those sutras in Japanese?" And I wanted to say, "It's not really Japanese, you know? It's Japanese phonetic pronunciation," but I didn't. I just said, "Yes, we are." And he shook his head like, "Brother, don't you ever change." But see, the thing that makes a sutra special is not the content, the intellectual content. See, and the fact that they don't really have an intellectual content is really very liberating. See, very liberating. You know, if you are holding the sutra book, you know, you have your spine erect, you're breathing with your hara, your dantian, and your whole being can resonate with these sutras. It's like the purest kind of communication, because it's really beyond words. It's your pure encounter with the moment, yeah? Without kind of mediation, in my opinion. The deepest part of the Teisho is the silences between the words. You need the words to have a Teisho. You know, I guess that's obvious. But don't be deceived, you know. It's the speech and the silence. And I was so surprised to see this person say this, you know, as if Zen was about, I mean, I'll be honest with you. I'm very glad you're coming to a Teisho, and I'll do my best. But the truth is that the content of this Teisho isn't going to help you very much. You know, and if you think you're learning something about Zen from listening to the Teisho, you're actually mistaken. Now, you could learn something about Zen this way. You decide you're not going to move during the Teisho. So you sit down on the cushion and you think, okay, Burmese, half lotus, full lotus, what's it going to be? Because I'm not going to move. I'm going to try not to move. And so you decide, okay, my legs are tired. I've been sitting since 7 o'clock, but I'm going to do a half lotus. I'm going to do a quarter lotus. You pull your leg up and it hurts a little bit, right? It's tired. And you straighten your back and you think, okay, I've got to get into deep samadhi before my leg starts to hurt. And you start watching your breath and watching your breath and watching your breath, and pretty soon you're in deep samadhi. And then there's this droning of my voice, sort of, on the edge of your consciousness, yeah? And it puts an added pressure on you, right? Because you've got to focus on your breath. You've got to focus on on mu, or on your koan. You've got to maintain your balance, your mental balance, and basically at the same time you're sort of listening to this droning on of my voice, you know? And the words are coming in and coming out, you know, phrases, maybe, you know? And this is like an ideal situation. During our meditation retreats, during our sesshin, many people tell me they have their best sit after the Teisho. You know, and they'll say, "Oh, you know, halfway through that Teisho, it was murder. You know, my legs were hurting. I was thinking, okay, I'm going to uncross my legs, but I didn't do it. And then I came back after a break and I sat down, and it was the deepest. The whole world disappeared. You know, and that's the function of Teisho." You know, years ago, when I was sitting with Genki Roshi, I used to struggle to get through Teisho without moving. And I used to get into deep mushin, deep samadhi of shunyata. But the voice, listen, the task of listening to Genki speak, it was distracting to me. It made it difficult. And I often didn't make it through. But then I began to make it through the whole teisho without moving. And, you know, I didn't really realize that anybody was paying attention to me. But I was sitting in the front row. And Genki was speaking, and Webb Sensei was translating. And I was sitting there thinking, okay, if this teisho goes on another 5 minutes, I'm going to move. You know? And then I back to my breath. And then I think, oh, Christ, you know, he's got to be finishing, you know. breath, and think, Galeen, this must be really long today, you know. So then I thought, oh, screw it. You know, I'm going to move my leg. And I put my hand down on my foot, and just then I looked up at Webb. He was looking right at me, and his face said, don't do it! You know, don't do it! And it wasn't mad. It was like, no! You know? So I didn't. And I made it through. But, this is a deeper understanding of the teisho, deeper understanding of teisho. It's, you know, there's a listening that you do in school where you have maybe a cup of coffee in your hand, you're sitting in a nice padded seat in a lecture hall, and maybe you have a little snack with you, you know. And you're taking notes, and you're evaluating what the person is saying or not. You're just taking notes thinking, you know, oh boy, this weekend I'm going to go into the city and listen to this or that. You know? And you're sort of listening, and you're evaluating, and maybe the teacher is entertaining, you know, maybe the teacher is stimulating, you know. But actually that, and maybe afterward you say, gee, those were some very interesting ideas. See, those are very interesting ideas. That's an extremely shallow, I think, experience, you know. And yet, you know, that's how many people think of, you know, around the country, a lot of people practice Zen like this. And I am criticizing. I'm not criticizing, but I guess that's not true. I am criticizing. They sit for half an hour, and then they all talk about it, right? This is like murder. This is like murdering what you just did, right? Very sad. You know, people go to talks, and they'll listen to, you know, often people in the Buddhist circuit, you know, will come and give a talk. So the Dalai Lama came here. You know, the Dalai Lama might come, or some Lama, some Bhante, some, and they come and give a talk, and people come and listen and think, oh, those are very interesting ideas, or I agree, or I disagree, you know. This is very, very shallow. You know, the idea that you could hear something and the idea would be, like, deeply transformative is, in my opinion, a total fiction. You know, in a year, you might remember just a few words of the talk, but they really won't have a deeply transformative effect on the way your mind works. They really won't. I don't believe that. You know. You know, I've had experiences where I've read something that was very stimulating. You know, I've read an essay or a poem. And I've read it, and it's been exciting me. Maybe so exciting I couldn't put it down, you know. Or I put it down, and I had to walk around because the ideas were so. That's wonderful. That's part of life. But you know, a year later, you might not remember the content of that at all. And the ultimate effect of that on your life is very shallow. You know, when we practice Zen, when we practice Chan, we're interacting with the world in a very different way, very different way. And I think, I personally think, much deeper way. I was just reading something. See, it's okay to read. And I found some interesting ideas, as a matter of fact. But don't be deceived, you know. These are just ideas. They're a dime a dozen, you know. Nevertheless, you know, I have to say something. But remember, the most important thing is not what I say. You know. Anyway, there was an article in The Guardian, a British newspaper, and it was about a neuroscientist whose name is Shanida Nataraj. And she said her parents were Hindu, and that they used to practice meditation. And then they tried other kinds of meditation too, and she said, I just thought it was ridiculous. You know, she said, my parents would be doing this meditation, and she said, I rebelled. We hate to believe that our parents know something we don't. So when I became a research scientist, I wanted some concrete proof that what they were doing worked. I really didn't expect to find that meditation plays such a role in optimizing brain function and health, from cognitive abilities to cardiovascular well-being. So she's written a book, The Blissful Brain, Neuroscience and the Power of Meditation. But what she found in her study was very interesting. She said the key to meditation success is whole brain integration. According to Nataraj, Westerners use the left halves of their brains too much. Generally speaking, the left hemisphere is associated with analytical, rational, and logical processing, whereas the right hemisphere is associated with abstract thought, nonverbal awareness, visual spatial perception, and the expression and modulation of emotions. In the Western world, most individuals navigate through their everyday life in a fashion strongly dominated by left brain thinking. So she says, people in the Western world, in particular, you know, maybe the modern world in general, are sort of right brain starved. You know, or right, you could say right brain ignorant, right? And she's done, you know, an extraordinary amount of research on this. But I think she's really got a point. You know, when we listen to a talk with our, I always get my hemispheres mixed up, but when we listen to our talk with the left hemisphere alone, you know, it's a very shallow experience. You know, Genki Roshi used to talk, and he used to talk in a very slow manner anyway. And then Webb would translate everything he said. And it made it interminably slow, you know. So he would go through this story, story, blah, 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 blah. And then Webb would go, he liked it, you know. So he'd go on and on and on and on, and he liked it. And then, you know, and then sometimes it would take Webb a huge amount to say something that Genki had said in just a few words, you know. But this would go on, this was the Taisho, you know. So very slow pace, right? And of course, we would hear these stories again and again, you know. And he would say, I'll never forget, you know, the time Yamamoto Genpo Roshi made udon, you know. And we go, he'd get halfway through it. And you could, with your left brain, you could say, I'll never forget the time Genpo Roshi, and we'd think, made udon, right, you know. And he put the onions in himself, right, you know. But on the other hand, you know, I have a bunch of tapes of Genki Roshi's Taishos. And when I listen to those tapes, someday I want to translate those tapes. I want to transcribe those tapes. But, you know, when I listen to those teshas, when I hear my teacher's voice, I feel like crying. Because I love him so much. You know, and he gave me so much, this beautiful practice of Zen. And I think of all the times I was so miserable in my practice. I couldn't answer my koans. You know, I was in darkness for months. Derailed, yes, derailed. And I would go in and see Genki Roshi and Dokusan, and he would throw me a rope, you know, some kind word that would keep me going. And he was so, you know, one time I got really very sick. I mean, really sick. And I was coming to sit in the morning, even though I was really sick, you know. I really shouldn't have been there, you know. I was probably infecting everybody else. My nose was running like a faucet. I was probably really gross, you know. Genki Roshi was so kind to me. He made me like a little extra soup, special soup, helped me get better. I can't really go through all the ways in which he helped me. Now, when I listen to his voice, you know, with my whole being, it's very different from when I listen to his voice with my discriminating mind. See, because the content of the talks isn't that important. I've heard all this, you know. In fact, you know, Genki Roshi's Dharma talks weren't that interesting, really. You know, in a certain way, they're sort of standard, generic talks on Zen practice. But when you add the right brain, suddenly the depth of this experience is like indescribable in language. And this is true for, I think, everything we do. Everything we do. I think Dr. Nataraj is quite correct to say that Western people are right brain starved. You know, we do live in a conceptually impoverished universe. And we see the results in everything humans do in the modern world. I mean, it takes extraordinary insensitivity to destroy the natural world as we are doing and have done. It only a creature who's incredibly alienated and who's been very badly damaged could behave as we behave. But it's this problem of we've killed half of, you know, what we are. Maybe that's what we mean by civilization. I don't know. I was shocked by this person's letter, and I thought, after all these years, which by the way was quite, I thought, rather arrogant, you know, because this person basically said, I know this, I don't know this teacher personally, but by reputation I know he's a very, very deep practitioner. And I had to say, I think this guy, to myself, I just thought, this person is really a pipsqueak, you know, as we used to say. You know, he's dismissing this very, very deep practitioner because he's only listening with his left brain. You know, only listening with his left brain. And, you know, when we practice Zen, it is difficult at first because we have this, training, this cultural training. You know, everything is processed through this left brain. I mean, this could just be, I mean, the brain's a little more complex than left and right hemispheres. That's sort of a shorthand. But the processing is shallow. The processing is one-dimensional. And Zen is learning how not to process that way. Learning that there's this other intelligence, this unified mind in the court. You know, Seng San, our great ancestor, Seng San said, called it unified mind in accord with the way. And Dr. Nataraj says, you know, it's whole brain integration. Now that's very close, right? I mean, that's, yes, Seng San was right. With a unified mind in accord with the way, all self-centered striving ceases. Doubts and irresolutions vanish, and life in truth becomes possible. So you know, sit on the cushion, and of course, we're addicted to processing in a certain way. But you know, people have to learn in the modern world how to have whole brain experience, whole mind experience. And actually, the brain is really not quite accurate, because when we sit on the cushion, we're using the whole body mind. You know, Westerners also think of intelligence as being housed in the brain. But actually, your intelligence is housed, first of all, it's housed in your whole nervous system. But it's also housed in the whole universe, right? The limits of my body are not what I think. The whole world is like my body, really. It's only a kind of left brain fantasy that says that's not true. So we're learning how to use the whole body to experience the moment. And people are very crude and very clumsy at this at first, you know. But this is why we don't sit in chairs. You know, basically, some people might think, you know, this is just crazy. Why do you sit on these cushions? Why don't you sit in a nice, comfortable chair? You know, isn't that the modern, you know, the modern man knows that this is an old superstition, sitting on these cushions? But actually, that's not true. You activate your nervous system in a different way. If you do meditation even for a month and you begin to sit down on a cushion, you'll notice perceptively that your mental state is different than when you're sitting in a chair listening to a lecture. You're stimulating certain nerves and other nerves are not being stimulated. You're activating nerve centers in certain ways, and you're processing information in a different way. You know, there's no real content. If you're watching the breath, there's no left brain content to that experience, you know. And indeed, people who start meditating just say, you know, well, I'm just watching my breath. It's just one breath after another. So they're just thinking, the left brain is looking and saying, oh, I know what the breath is. Breath, breath, breath. You know, when is this guy going to give me a real koan? Something with some meat on it. So, you know, he's looking for a koan like, you know, tell me, is it one or many? See, that's perfect. Is it one or many? And then you can go back and think, well, you know, Plato says, you know, you can use that left brain. And you say, well, no, just watch the breath. There's no content there. And you watch the breath for a while, but eventually what happens is that you start experiencing the moment differently. You know, you might say, well, last night, I was talking to somebody, and I said, how was your sit? And this is somebody who had drifted away. He came to practice, and he was practicing rather faithfully, and then he went away. And something drew him back here last night, and I said, how was your sit? And he said, the strangest thing happened. I felt like I was sitting there, and I felt suddenly like I pushed a big, heavy block off a cliff. And then there was just nothing there. You know, and I don't know if he'll come back or not, but I thought to myself, damn, that was great, you know, but you had a great sit, you know, and I think I didn't say damn, the damn part, but I said, wow, that was great, and he looked at me like, he didn't get it, I don't think, you know, I mean, I was like jumping up and down with joy, and it was, for him, it was just sort of a weird experience, but he had a deep experience of Mushin, deep experience of Mushin, and his whole brain was activated, right? That he was experiencing the moment in a very different way. See? And I tried to encourage him. I said, "Oh, that's wonderful. You know, please come back." And I mean, he's a nice guy, but he sort of looked like, "Yeah, yeah, sure." Yeah. So you know that we're just our, if we had a different culture, see, I mean that would be like, and that would be like getting a tax rebate, right? You know, in our culture, you know, scratching some numbers on a little card and getting $200 would be like it would make your month, right? You know, or you know, I mean, basically, our culture doesn't say this is important. But if our, you know, if our culture said this is really important, and we understood the problem a little better with our left brains, I guess, you know, people would appreciate this kind of an achievement, which was a really lucky break for this guy. You know, so he had had this experience which makes no sense in the left brain. You know, he said, "I felt like I was pushing a heavy weight and it suddenly went over a cliff and then there was just this open space." And that's a deep experience of the moment. Really wonderful. So, you know, little by little, we start learning how to experience the moment with our whole being, body, heart, and mind. And we become a different kind of organism, in my opinion, you know, a different kind of organism. The koan is... A really good koan. This is one of the most important koans in the whole collection, I think. Mihu is a master, and he wants one of his students to go over and talk to Yang Shan. And he's sort of saying, "Go ask this question. I wonder how Yang Shan would answer this." You know, we don't know why Mihu didn't go himself. Maybe he was afraid of Yang Shan. So he said, "Go ask Yang Shan this question: do people these days need enlightenment or not?" See, that could be a left brain question. You know, so you could sit there and think, "Well, do people need enlightenment? Is it a need? You know, is our society changing? Does the need for enlightenment change as society changes? Is enlightenment a permanent condition?" You know, these kinds of left brain responses. Yang Shan said, "It's not that there is no enlightenment or no need for enlightenment. What can be done about falling into the secondary?" That's such a great, great answer. I wanted to read you something else. And your left brain may not think this is connected to the koan, but your right brain might feel differently about it. This is an article about you know, our tradition here is Linji Zen, and it's called Rinzai Zen in the United States. And there was an article in a newspaper. It was entitled "Zen Centenarian." It's about a 101-year-old Zen teacher, and his name is Joshu Sasaki Roshi. Let's see. He's interviewed by a reporter. And the reporter probably doesn't quite fully understand Zen, hasn't had the experiences we're talking about. But he's written a very nice article, and he has a little question and answer with Sasaki Roshi. I'll read you a little bit of the article. "Anyone who lives more than a century and maintains sharpness of mind is likely to have a great deal of wisdom to share. Imagine the wealth of insight the last surviving master of the Rinzai school of Zen Buddhism has to offer just 2 days after his 101st birthday." This is like a mistake, of course. course, because he's not the last surviving master. They're all over the place, but he's the last surviving master who's over 100. That's true. So who knows what the guy meant, but anyway, he has a good discussion of the Roshi. And then he asks him some questions. So he says, he asks him a question about what is it you do when you sit on the cushion? You know, let's see if I can find the exact part. Here's what he said. He said, the reporter asked him, what's the relationship between Buddha or enlightenment and God? And Joshu Roshi said, the teaching of Buddha is different from the teaching of God. Buddhism is the teaching of karma. Karmic activity is not one but two opposing activities that are creating this world we live in, as well as we ourselves. So that at times the two opposing activities appear in unified form, but this state of unification is not fixed, and at once breaks into plus and minus, he said, chuckling. The foundation state is reached when we are at perfect zero. And the Buddha teaches that this zero is the manifestation of true love. Plus is self-affirming activity, and minus is self-negating activity. When separated, the distance between them is the beginning of I am self. Okay? I think that's great. I think that's excellent. When you, one of the interesting things that you'll begin to notice if you're using your whole being, left and right brain, you have a unified mind in accord with the way, is that the universe is not the way we see it when we use just the left brain. So, for example, if you're seated on the cushion and you watch your breath, and you're looking at it with your left brain, you just say, oh, it's one breath after another. If you begin to have like whole brain experience and you're watching your breath, you know, you notice that the breath is going out your forehead or out your eyes or out the top of your head, or your hands and your face become numb and so on. And at some point, you know, it might actually be the case that you can't find your breath anymore. So you're watching the breath, and you're watching the breath, and you're watching the breath, and if you're watching with your whole mind, suddenly the breath disappears. Or another way to put it is, as you follow the breath out, at the end of the breath, everything becomes blank and dark, or maybe blank and light. Yeah? One of the interesting things is that if you watch the breath long enough, the breath just disappears. It's like pushing a heavy weight to the edge of a cliff, and the weight is pushed off the cliff, and then there's just empty space, see? Just what that guy described last night. The fact is that you could do that. You could have the same experience if you looked at not your breath, but if you looked at a candle, or if you looked at an apple, or if you looked at any object of attention will eventually disappear. Or another way to put it is, if you watch anything long enough, your mind will become blank and dark. Now that's interesting. Now, you know, that's interesting to me, and very, very important. But you'll never notice it if you're just a left brain processor. Now here's another thing that's kind of interesting. If you are deeply in Mushin, you go deeply into Mushin, sometimes it seems like everything in the universe disappears, because indeed in deep Mushin, everything in the universe does disappear. You might feel like you have no body left, and you might feel that absolutely everything is gone. Yeah? Just totally gone. It's deep. Many of you have been there. I know this. In deep mushin. Yeah? But no matter how long you practice, if you stay in deep mushin long enough, something is going to quote unquote bring you out of it, right? So you can enter the deepest mushin, but all of a sudden you're going to have a thought or a body sensation, or you're going to hear a sound. See, now you know that might seem trivial, but it's terrifically important. Please don't worry about why, just take my word for it. Terrifically important. Because any object which is observed with the whole brain long enough disappears. And if you stay in mushin long enough, something appears. And for the longest time, people think this is a problem, especially when things appear. You go into the deepest mushin, and then all of a sudden, boom, you become aware of, you start thinking about lunch, or you hear a bird, or you open your eyes and you look at the light on the floor. And you think, I just couldn't stay in mushin. See, so you think there's a problem. This is what screws people up in Zen practice, you know. We have so many left brain presuppositions. But what kind of universe is it, by the way, where things are, disappear and reappear? Well, I don't think we know with our left brain, but I think if you use your super brain, your supercomputer, you can begin to understand that it's not the universe we think it is. Yeah? It's not the universe we think it is. Go into the deepest mushin, and something is going to appear. And watch something, and it's going to disappear. Again, you know, this might just seem strange or weird, but very, very, very important. The universe is not at all, in my opinion, the way we think it is on the basis of our left brain experience. How does the... In a way, you know, Joshi Roshi says too much. He sounds like he's making a left brain statement. But, you know, there's no danger that the reporter is going to understand him anyway. So he's so direct, it's shocking, right? But that's okay, because nobody's going to get it. Let me see, there's one other thing I wanted to read you that I thought was great. Good thing the silence is the best part of the Taisho, huh? He said, question, you have vowed to plant the seed of Buddhism, Zen Buddhism, in this country before you die. Has the seed been planted sufficiently? He said, I planted, but the United States doesn't give enough fertilizer. So the seed is growing, but he says, the democracy of this country is not real democracy, so it's difficult. I think that's true, too. You know? One of the... when you begin to experience... the universe through your unified mind in accord with the way, you know, the tea in your hand is as important and as beautiful and as wonderful as, you know, the Mona Lisa. And the moment you walk out of this building is as important as the signing of the Declaration of Independence. Now, everything and everyone in this world is really Buddha. a Buddha. Everything and everyone in this world is really, you know, quote unquote God. And this is what the Roshi means when he says not really democracy. Right? You can't have a left brain democracy. Left brain says you're higher or lower than I am. You're better or worse. You're wrong or you're right. Yeah? This is the left brain universe. Right brain universe says everything is one life. Your precious life is my precious life. I am your servant because you are my life. Yeah? And you say that to every person without discrimination. Every person without is my true self. If you can't say that yet, democracy hasn't arrived. I think this is what he means. So, Mihu had a monk ask Yangshan, "Do people need enlightenment these days or not? Should we pursue enlightenment or not?" Yangshan said, "Look, cut the crap." You know, just don't worry about enlightenment. Just stop cutting the world in two. Just stop cutting the world in two. Just stop separating right from wrong, good from bad, enlightenment from ignorance. Stop left-braining the world, yeah? The monk went back and reported this to Mihu, and Mihu said, "Yeah, he's got it." The secondary, distinguishing enlightenment, breaking up delusion. Quickly, you should free your hands and relinquish the net and the trap. That's the discriminating mind. Accomplishment, before it's exhausted, becomes an extra thumb, something we don't need, right? Wisdom doesn't know. The unified mind, in accord with the way, encounters everything as itself. You know, what we call knowledge is always separated. Yeah. So he said, you can't know anything. It's like trying to bite your own navel. The full moon's icy disk weeps in the autumn dew. Birds are cold in the jade tree. The dawn breeze is chill. Remember, cold is good in the Zen world, right? Cold means freedom from illusion. Okay? Brought forth, great Yang distinguishes real and false. Completely without flaw, the white jade is esteemed. Everything is basically without flaw. Sounds nice, doesn't it? So please, you know, you came here today to practice Zen. Many of us have practiced together for years and years. And every time I see you, I'm so happy to see you. And practicing with you is a great thrill. It's the thrill of my life. So please keep doing such an excellent job. And let's walk this beautiful path of Zen.